Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here today. My name is Tej Azmay, and I work at the George Padman Institute. So we're an archive based in Finsbury Park, hello. And we've been there since 1991, but we grew out of a movement that's been going since at least the 1960s. And I'll tell you more about the history of that. But I think what we're going to focus on today is largely the importance of archiving as resistance work. I'm going to share kind of a taster of how to build your own archive. We're running courses in the next few weeks that Tash and Debs are actually going to be part of, so I hope to see some of you there. And then we'll play some exercises to get you thinking about how you can build your own archives with the work that you're doing too. Also, quick request, Tash, someone asked if we could turn the heating on, if there is heating.
Pretty much on.
Sorry. Right. Cool. So, George Padmore Institute, based on Stradbroom Road. We grew out of New Beacon Books, which formed in 1968-67. I was formed by a guy called John LaRose, who was an oil union worker from the Caribbean. He came over in the sort of late 60s, married a woman called Sarah White, who is still alive and still up, like going around. So if you come to the bookshop, you'll meet her.
Just careful with the mic, because if you hit it,
oh, sorry.
You can hear it.
Sorry,
I might just leave it. I might just leave it. And we're quite an interesting archive in that our collections grew out of the activity of the people who were involved in the organisation. A lot of archives kind of pull information out from other places, but our archive literally came from the living rooms and cupboards of the trustees of the organisation. So the collection grew. Cool. Well, the collection grew from the networks of grassroots activism.
Illegal things are happening.
I'll keep it moving. So the collection grew out of grassroots activism and cultural activity that a lot of our trustees and members were part of. So these were activist networks such as the Black Parents Movement. Parents that literally came together to resist the racism that their children were facing, not only in schools, but on the streets in the face of the police. We have the Caribbean Artist Movement. I've got like a book here that I can pass around to show you. But the Caribbean Artist Movement were a group of artists, writers, musicians that came together just after the decolonial moment in the Caribbean to ask the fundamental question, what does it mean to be a Caribbean in this moment after the colonial experiment, quote unquote, if you can say that. And they were thinking about how they could preserve their own languages, how they could preserve their own cultures, and a lot of our records are kind of the first pieces of writing by Black and African people in the UK published by a Black publishing house. So the bookshop was also a publishing house, just to say. So we have over 12,000 records in the building. We kind of cover, I think the reason why I love the archive so much is that I think it focuses on that moment after the Windrush to the present. For me, kind of exists as this kind of cultural chasm, this gap that we don't really talk about. And so if you're curious about the development of modern poetry in Martinique, or if you're curious about slight spirits don't really want me to be doing this today. If you're just curious about the development of contemporary Black culture around the world, you can come to the archive and discover it, and that's what really matters to me. I think you can fill in a lot of very important historical gaps. And also you can trace the formation of political identities and resistance movements within the context of the UK, which we don't have very much of. I've got a quote here from John LaRose, who was the founder. He said that growing up in a colonial society in the Caribbean made me acutely aware that colonial policy was based on the deliberate withholding of information from the population. There was also, as you both pointed to, a discontinuity of information from generation to for John. He called himself a social creative, or he called activism social creativity. And so for him, publishing, writing books, writing poetry, those things coexisted with his activism, and he didn't separate them, which is why the bookshop became such a hub of activism as well. So he said, publishing, therefore, was a vehicle to give an independent validation of one's own culture, history, and politics, a sense of self, and to make a break with continuity. So this is like really basic stuff, but for John and everyone at the archive, information is activism. A lot of the documents in the archive are going to be thrown away. They're going to be skipped or burnt. And they saw the value in them and worked hard to protect them. So they dedicated their lives, essentially, to sharing information in lots of different ways. But more importantly, they saw it as part of the movement work that they were doing. The Black Parents Movement had these sort of 8 principles, one of which was to make sure that you collected accurate information for your activism. So it meant that in real time, when they were doing their campaigns against the state, whether it was the police or teachers, they had an archive that they were forming of evidence to counter the state. And so I think it's quite important for you to think about that in the work you're doing. And I've got some archives with me, but this quote is from a Race Today report that was written in 1973. And it's shocking to read it any week, but I think particularly reading it this week has quite made me feel quite sick in lots of ways, because you could have written it today. And one of the things that the writers put in there was, Britain has never thought her subject peoples had any civil liberties, either in the colonies or here. So all that they can do, all that we can do, is to self-organise. And that is, I guess, the fundamental point of building your own archives. So, why archive for resistance? So these are some of the ideas that kind of float around as principles for us to work with at the George Pagan Institute. So people who are denied the civil liberties are not seen as human. If you're not human, then you don't have a story. Someone else can write that for you and destroy your life, as the state is doing to lots of people. A lot of the information in our collection, as I said, is going to be thrown away. And I think some of the things that I'm particularly proud of us doing over the last year at the archive has been connecting with activist groups to help them develop their own collections, and seeing those collections then being used as evidence in live legal cases. And if that stuff got thrown away, then we wouldn't have that, in cases in 2019. So we're going to do this later, but really be thinking about the information that you have, the activity that you're part of, and the things that you're collating, and how they can be used in the future as resistance, as a tool to enrich the kind of fight for justice for someone else. So that data enables us to remember histories of injustice and resistance. And I think also this week I've been having a few rants about this, but they help us to question our political identities and our positions, and help us map how these things have developed over time. So I think like this week there's been lots of quite painful to witness position taking when it comes to the question of deportation, who suffers within that, who is a victim of the state when it comes to immigration policy. Lots of really difficult fractures, not just between Africans and Caribbeans, but with Asian communities as well. And I think the archives that I focused on bringing with me today show just the breadth of who has been a victim of this politics for a long time. And I think underneath all of that, it helps us to remember the patterns that gave birth to this injustice in the first place, like the very logic, and how that logic has been reinforced time and time again. Like you can see, if you look through the collections and you trace the development of every Immigration Act, you can kind of, it's like a DJ loop. They say the same thing almost verbatim every 7 years. So our approach to archiving, as I said at the beginning, they've grown quite organically. Most of the team at the archive now are also part of the movements, which is sometimes a good thing, sometimes not so much a good thing if you're so close to the history. A lot of it has just come from their cupboards and attics, so again, think about your keeping. And back in the 90s, they literally started off doing grassroots workshops to figure out how to archive. And it's really only over the last decade and a half but they've become more formal and they've received funding to both create, typo, and consolidate and catalogue our collections. So, we're going to be doing some more formal archiving courses over the next 3 months if you're interested in coming. They're in partnership with the University of Leicester, and Natasha and Debs are going to be at the first one. So we'll be covering things like how to structure a collection, how to catalogue, preservation of your material, access and visibility, and the politics of use. Obviously, I only have 45 minutes with you today, so we're going to do a very mini archiving workshop with you. Yes. This brings me to you. So I know a lot of you in here are involved in resistance work, and because the work you're doing is so important, one thing that Tash often says that I find quite inspiring is that movements move so quickly that we often don't have time to slow down and reflect on what we're doing or why we're doing it. So consider this like a 15-minute hiatus for you to reflect on what you're doing and really think about the future value of it. So next slide. Imagine that it's 1969, friends together, yeah. So we've got like 20 minutes. I want to think about what you're leaving behind. You know, really think about in 50 years' time, what materials are going to make up your archive? How are you currently looking after this material? How do you want your work to be contextualized in the future? That's quite a life question for me, working at an archive with a political history, as someone who's interested in politics and liberation. And I think when archives become more formal, they can also become quite depoliticized. And so there's a tension between the content of the collection and what an institution demands you become. And that can weaken the contextualization of your material. So really think, how do you want people to remember what you're doing? And who would you like to have access to your collection? The more formal an institution becomes, the more likely it is that it's mainly going to be academics and researchers. And as I said earlier, some of the most powerful work that we've been doing over the last year hasn't been with people in formal institutions. It's been with groups of school children or people who've been kicked out of school or activists who are campaigning for justice for their communities. And how in 2019 could you begin making this happen? So, because there are so many of you, if in your rows, you could work together to answer those questions for 15 minutes, and then one of you can share back if we have time. Does that all make sense for everyone? Yeah. Yeah? Does it?
Just do something I get back.